All these amounts have been fixed by physical requirements and limits of various kinds. The total pressure had to be high enough to drive oxygen into the blood, and 500 millibars was what was obtained on Earth at about the 4,000-meter elevation, near the upper limit of what people could live at permanently. Given that it was near the upper limit, it would be best if such a thin atmosphere had more than the Terran percentage of oxygen in it, but it couldn't be too much more, or else fires might be hard to extinguish. Meanwhile, CO2 had to be kept below 10 millibars, or else it would be poisonous. As for nitrogen, the more the better. In fact, 780 millibars would be ideal. But the total nitrogen inventory on Mars was now estimated at less than 400 millibars, so 300 millibars was as much as one could reasonably ask to put into the air, and perhaps more. Lack of nitrogen was in fact one of the biggest problems the terraforming effort faced. They needed more than they had, both in the air and in their soil. Sax stared down at his plate and ate in silence, thinking hard about all these factors. The morning's discussions had given him cause to wonder whether he had made the right decisions back in 2042. Whether the volatile inventory could justify his attempt to go straight for a human viable surface in a single stage, not that there was much that could be done about it now. And all things considered, he still thought they were the right decisions. Shikata Ganai, really, if they wanted to walk freely on the surface of Mars in their own lifetimes. Even if their lifetimes were going to be considerably extended. But there were people who seemed more concerned with high temperatures than breathability. Apparently they were confident that they could balloon the CO2 level, heat things tremendously, and then reduce the CO2 without problems. Sax was dubious about that. Any two-phase operation was going to be messy, so messy that Sax couldn't help wondering if they would get stuck with the 20,000-year timescales predicted in the earliest two-phase models. It made him blink to think of it. He couldn't see the need. Were people really willing to risk such a long-term problem? Could they be so impressed by the new gigantic technologies that were becoming available that they believed anything was possible? How was the pastrami? Burkina asked. The what? The pastrami. That's the kind of sandwich you just ate, Stephen. Oh, fine, fine. It must have been fine. The afternoon sessions were mostly devoted to problems caused by the successes of the global warming campaign. As surface temperatures rose and the underground biota began to penetrate deeper into the regolith, the permafrost down there was melting, just as hoped. But this was proving disastrous in certain permafrost-rich regions. One of these, unfortunately, was Isidis planitia itself. A well-attended talk by an aerologist from a Praxis lab in Burrows described the situation. Isidis was one of the big old impact basins, about the size of our gyre, with its northern side completely erased and its southern rim now part of the Great Escarpment. Underground ice had been creeping off the escarpment and pooling in the basin for billions of years. Now the ice near the surface was melting and in the winters freezing again. This thaw-freeze cycle was causing frost heaving on an unprecedented scale. It was pretty near the usual 2-magnitude enlargement compared to similar phenomena on Earth, and karsts and pingos 100 times the size of their Terran analogs were big holes and big mounds. All over Isidis, these giant new holes and hummocks were blistering the landscape, and after her talk and a sequence of mind-boggling slides, the aerologist led a large group of interested scientists to the south end of Burrows, past Moeris Lacus Mesa to the tent wall, where the neighborhood looked like it had been devastated by earthquake, the ground having heaved up to reveal a rising mass of ice like a bald, round hill. "This is a fine specimen of a pingo," the aerologist said with a proprietary air. "The ice masses are relatively pure compared to the permafrost matrix, and they act in the matrix the same way rocks do. When the permafrost refreezes at night or in winter, it expands, and anything hard stuck in this expansion gets pushed upward toward the surface. There's a lot of pingos in Terran tundra, but none as big as this one." She led the group up the shattered concrete of what had been a flat street, and they stared out from an earthen crater rim onto a mound of dirty white ice. "We've lanced it like a boil and are melting it and piping it into the canals." "Out in the country, one of these coming up would be like an oasis," Sachs remarked to Jessica. "It would melt in the summer and hydrate the ground around it. We ought to develop a community of seeds and spores and rhizomes that we could scatter on any sites like this out in the country." "True," Jessica said, "although to be realistic, the permafrost country is mostly going to end up under the Vastatus Sea anyway." The truth was, Sachs had temporarily forgotten the drilling and mining in Vastatus. When they had returned to the conference center, he deliberately looked for a talk describing an aspect of that work. There was one at 4. Recent advances in North Polar Lens permafrost pumping procedures. He watched the speaker's video show impassively. The lens of ice that extended underground from the northern polar cap was like the submerged part of an iceberg containing some 10 times as much water as the visible cap. The Vastatus permafrost contained even more. But getting that water to the surface, like the retrieval of nitrogen from Titan's atmosphere, it was a project so massive that Sachs had never even considered it in the early years. It simply hadn't been possible then. All these big projects, the Soleta, the nitrogen from Titan, the Northern Ocean drilling, the frequent arrival of ice asteroids, were on a scale that Sachs found he was having trouble adjusting to. They were thinking big these days, the transnationals. Certainly the new abilities in design and in materials science, and the emergence of fully self-replicating factories, were what made the projects technically feasible, but the initial financial investments were still huge. As for the technical capabilities involved, he found himself adjusting to the idea of them fairly rapidly. It was an extension of what they had done in the old days. Solve some initial problems in materials, design, and homeostatic control, and one's powers grew very considerable indeed. One might say that their reach no longer exceeded their grasp, which, given the directions their reach sometimes took, was a frightening thought. In any case, some 50 drilling platforms were now located in the northern 60s, boring wells and inserting permafrost melting devices at their bottoms that ranged from heated collection galleries to nuclear explosives. The new meltwater was then being pumped up and distributed over the dunes of Vastatus Borealis, where it froze again. Eventually, this ice sheet would melt, partly under its own weight, and they would have an ocean in the shape of a ring around the northern 60s and 70s, no doubt a very good thermal sink, as all oceans were, although while it remained an ice sea, the increase in albedo would probably make it a net heat loss to the global system. Yet another example of their operations cutting against each other, as was the location of Burrows itself relative to this new sea. The city was somewhat below the sea level most often mentioned, the datum itself. People talked of a dike or a smaller sea, but no one knew for sure. It was all very interesting. So Sachs attended the conference every day, all day, living in the hushed rooms and halls of the conference center, chatting with colleagues and the authors of posters and his neighbors in audiences. More than once he had to pretend not to know old associates, and it made him nervous enough that he avoided them when he could. But people didn't seem to feel that he reminded them of someone they knew, and for the most part he was able to concentrate on the science. He did that with gusto. People gave talks, asked questions, debated details of fact, discussed implications, all under the uniform fluorescent glow of the conference rooms in the low hum of ventilators and video machines, as if they were in a world outside of time and space, in the imaginary space of pure science, surely one of the greatest achievements of the human spirit, a kind of utopian community, cozy and bright and protected. For Sachs, a scientific conference was utopia. The sessions at this conference, however, had a new tone, a kind of nervous edge that Sachs had never witnessed before and didn't like. The questions after the presentations were more aggressive, the answers more quickly defensive. The pure play of scientific discourse, which he so enjoyed, and which admittedly was never quite pure, was now more and more diluted by sheer argument, by obvious power struggles, motivated by something more than the usual egotism. It wasn't like Simmons' unconscionable lift from Borajani and Borajani's exquisite riposte. It was more a matter of direct assault, as at the end of a presentation on deep moholes and the possibility of reaching the mantle, when a short, bald Terran stood and said, "I don't think the basic model of the lithosphere here is valid," and then walked out of the room. Sachs witnessed this in complete disbelief. "What is his problem?" he whispered to Claire. She shook her head. "He works for Tsubarashi on the aerial lens, and they don't like any potential competition for their regolith melting program." My lord. The question and answer session staggered on, shaken by this display of rudeness, but Sachs slipped out of the room and stared down the hall curiously after the Tsubarashi scientist. What could he be thinking? But this miscreant wasn't the only one acting strange. People were stressed, nerves were on edge. Of course, the stakes were high. As the pingo below Moeris Lacus showed in a small-scale way, there were going to be some bad side effects to the procedures being studied and advocated at the conference, side effects which would cost money, time, lives. And then there were financial motivations. And now that they were entering its final days, the programming was shifting from very specific issues to more general presentations and workshops, including some presentations in the main room on the big new projects, what people were calling the monster projects. These were going to have such major impacts that they affected almost everyone else's programs. So when they discussed them, they were arguing policy, in effect, talking about what to do next rather than about what had already happened. That always made things more of a wrangle, but never more so than now, as people began to try to plug the information from the earlier presentations into advocacy for their own causes, whatever they might be. They were entering that unfortunate zone where science began to drift into politics, where papers became grant proposals. And it was dismaying to see that degraded dark zone invade the heretofore neutral terrain of a conference. Part of this, Sachs reflected over a solitary lunch, was no doubt caused by the big science nature of the monster projects. They were all so expensive and difficult that they had been contracted out to different transnationals. This was a plausible strategy on the face of it. An obvious efficiency move, but unfortunately, it meant that the different angles of attack on the terraforming problem now had interested parties defending them as the best methods, twisting data in order to defend their own ideas. Praxis, for instance, was the leader, along with Switzerland, in the very extensive bioengineering effort, and so its representative theoreticians defended what they called the ecopoiesis model, which claimed that no further influx of heat or volatiles was necessary at this point, and that biological processes alone, aided by a minimum of ecological engineering, would be sufficient to terraform the planet to the levels envisioned in the early Russell model. Sachs thought they were probably correct in this judgment, given the arrival of the Saleta, though he deemed their timescales optimistic. And he worked for Beatique, so possibly his judgment was skewed. The scientists from Armscor, however, were adamant that the low nitrogen inventory would cripple any ecopoetic hopes. They insisted that continued industrial intervention was necessary, and of course it was Armscor that was building the Titan nitrogen transfer shuttles. People from Consolidated, in charge of the drilling in Vastatas, emphasized the vital importance of an active hydrosphere. And people from Tsubarashi, in charge of the new mirrors, touted the great power of the Saleta and the aerial lens to pump heat and gases into the system, allowing everything else to accelerate. It was always quite obvious why people were advocating one program over another. You could look at people's name tags and see their institutional affiliation and predict what they were going to support or attack. To see science twisted so blatantly, pain sacks a great deal, and it seemed to him that it distressed everyone there, even the ones doing it, which added to the general irritability and defensiveness. Everyone knew what was going on, and no one liked it, and yet no one would admit it. Nowhere was this more apparent than in the last morning's panel discussion of the CO2 question. This quickly became a defense of the Saleta and the aerial lens, made very vehemently by the two Tsuburashi scientists on the panel. Sachs sat at the back of the room and listened to their enthusiastic description of the big mirrors, feeling more and more tense and unhappy as they went on. He liked the Saleta itself, which was no more than the logical extension of the mirrors he had been putting into orbit from the very beginning. But the low-flying aerial lens was clearly an extremely powerful instrument, and if wielded on the surface to anywhere near its full capacity, it would volatilize hundreds of millibars of gases into the atmosphere, much of its CO2, which according to Sachs's single-phase model they didn't want, and which in any sensible course of action would stay bonded in the regolith. No, there were several hard questions that needed to be asked about the effects of this aerial lens, and the Tsuburashi people ought to be harshly censured for beginning the melting of the regolith without consulting anyone outside their UNTA rubber-stamp committee about it. But Sachs didn't want to draw attention to himself, and so he could only sit there by Claire and Burkina with his lectern out, squirming in his seat and hoping that someone else would ask the hard questions for him. And as they were obvious questions as well as hard, they did get asked. A scientist from Mitsubishi, which was in a perpetual hometown feud with Tsuburashi, stood and inquired very politely about the runaway greenhouse effect that might result from too much CO2. Sachs nodded emphatically. But the Tsuburashi scientists replied that this was exactly what they were hoping for, that there couldn't be too much heat, and that an eventual atmospheric pressure of 700 or 800 millibars would be preferable to 500 anyway. "But not if it's CO2, Sachs muttered to Claire, who nodded. H.X. Borajani stood to say the same. He was followed by others. Many in the room were still using Sachs's original model as their template for action, and they insisted in many different ways on the difficulty of scrubbing any great excess of CO2 from the air. But there were also a good many scientists, from Arms Corps and Consolidated, as well as Tsuburashi, who either claimed that scrubbing CO2 would not be difficult, or else that a CO2-heavy atmosphere would not be so bad. An ecosystem of mostly plants, with CO2-tolerant insects and perhaps some genetically engineered animals, would flourish in the warm, thick air, and people could walk around in their shirt sleeves with nothing more cumbersome than a face mask. This set Sachs's teeth on edge, and happily he was not the only one, so he could stay in his seat while others rose to their feet to challenge this fundamental shift in the goal of terraforming. The argument quickly became heated, even rancorous. "It's not a jungle planet we're after here. You're making a hidden assumption that people can be genetically engineered to tolerate higher CO2 levels, but it's ridiculous." Very soon it became clear that they were accomplishing nothing. No one was really listening, and everyone had their opinions which were tightly aligned to their employer's interests. It was unseemly, really. A mutual distaste for the tone of the debate caused all but the immediate participants to withdraw. Around Sachs, people were folding programs, turning off lecterns, whispering to their companions, all while people were still standing and speaking. Bad form, no doubt about it. But it only took a moment's thought to realize that they were now arguing over policy decisions that were not going to be made at the level of working scientists anyway. No one liked that. And people actually began to get up and leave the room right in the middle of the discussion. The overwhelmed panel moderator, an overpolite Japanese woman who was looking miserable, spoke over the rising voices and suggested that they close the session. People trooped into the halls in little knots, some still talking heatedly to their allies, making their cases decisively, now that they were only complaining to their friends. Sachs followed Claire and Jessica and the other Biotique people across the canal and into Hunt Mesa. They took the elevator up to the Mesa Plateau and had lunch at Antonio's. They're going to flood us with CO2, Sax said, unable to hold his tongue any longer. I don't think they understand what a fundamental blow that will be to the standard model.
It's a different model entirely, Jessica said. A two-phase, heavy industrial model.
But it will keep people and animals in tents more or less indefinitely, Sax said.
Maybe the Transnat executives don't mind that, Jessica said.
Maybe they like it, Burkina said. Sax made a face.
Claire said, It could just be that they've got this Saleta and lens and they want to use them, like playing with toys. It's so much like the magnifying glass you used to start fires with when you're 10, but this one is so powerful, they can't stand not to use it. And then calling the burn zones canals, you know.
That is so stupid, Sax said sharply. And when the others stared at him in some surprise, he tried to lighten his tone. Well, it's just so silly, you know. It's such a kind of fuzzy romanticism. They won't be canals in the sense of usefully connecting one body of water with another, and even if they tried to use them, the banks would be slag.
Glass, they're claiming, Claire said. And it's just the idea of canals anyway.
But it's not a game we're playing here, Sax said. It was extremely hard to keep Stephen's sense of humor about it. For some reason, it was really irritating to him, really distressing. Here they had started so well, 60 years of solid achievement, and now different people were hacking about with different ideas and different toys, arguing and working against each other, bringing ever more powerful and expensive methods to bear, but with ever less coordination. They were going to ruin his plan. The afternoon's closing sessions were perfunctory and did nothing to restore his faith in the conference as disinterested science. That evening, back in his room, he watched the environmental news on vid more closely than ever, searching for answers to questions he hadn't quite formulated. Cliffs were falling. Rocks of all sizes were being shoved out of the permafrost by the thaw-freeze cycle, the rocks arranging themselves into characteristic polygonal patterns. Rock glaciers were forming in ravines and chutes, the rocks pried free by ice and then sliding down gorges in masses that behaved much like ice glaciers. Pingos were blistering the northern lowlands, except, of course, where the frozen seas were pouring out of the drilling platforms, inundating the land. It was change on a massive scale, becoming apparent everywhere now and accelerating every year as the summers got warmer and the sub-Martian biota grew deeper, while everything still froze solid every winter and froze a little bit almost every summer night. Such an intense freeze-thaw cycle would tear any landscape apart, and the Martian landscape was particularly susceptible to it, having been stalled in a cold, arid stasis for millions of years. Mass wasting was causing many landslides a day, and fatalities and unexplained disappearances were not at all uncommon. Cross-country travel was dangerous. Canyons and fresh craters were no longer safe places to locate a town or even to spend a night. Sax stood and walked to the window of his room, looked down at the lights of the city. All of this was as Anne had predicted to him long ago. No doubt she was noting reports of all the changes with disgust, she and all the rest of the Reds. For them, every collapse was a sign that things were going wrong rather than right. In the past, Sax would have shrugged them off. Mass wasting exposed frozen soil to the sun, warming it and revealing potential nitrate sources and the like. Now, with the conference fresh in his mind, he wasn't so sure. On the vid, no one seemed to be worrying about it. There were no Reds on vid. The collapse of landforms were considered no more than an opportunity, not only for terraforming, which seemed to be considered the exclusive business of the Transnats, but for mining. Sax watched a news account of a freshly revealed vein of gold ore with a sinking feeling. It was strange how many people seemed to feel the lure of prospecting. That was Mars as the 22nd century began. With the elevator returned, they were back to the old gold rush mentality, it seemed, as if it really were a manifest destiny,
out on the frontier with great tools wielded left and right. Cosmic engineers, mining and building. And the terraforming that had been his work, the sole focus of his life, in fact, for 60 years or more, seemed to be turning into something else. Insomnia began to plague Sax. He had never suffered the phenomenon before and found it quite uncomfortable. He would wake, roll over, gears in his mind would catch, and everything would start whirring. When it was clear he wasn't going to fall back asleep, he would get up and turn on the AI screen and watch video programs, even the news, which he had never watched before. He saw symptoms of some kind of sociological dysfunction on Earth. It did not appear, for instance, that they had even attempted to adjust their societies to the impact of the population rise caused by the gerontological treatments. That should have been elementary. Birth control, quotas, sterilization, the lot. But most countries hadn't done any of that. Indeed, it appeared that a permanent underclass of the untreated was developing, especially in the highly populated poor countries. Statistics were hard to come by now that the UN was moribund, but one World Court study claimed that 70% of the population of the developed nations had gotten the treatment, while only 20% had in the poor countries. If that trend held for long, Sax thought, it would lead to a kind of physicalization of class, a late emergence or retroactive unveiling of Marx's bleak vision, only more extreme than Marx, because now class distinctions would be exhibited as an actual physiological difference caused by a bimodal distribution, something almost akin to speciation. This divergence between rich and poor was obviously dangerous, but it seemed to be taken on Earth as something of a given, as if it were part of nature. Why couldn't they see the danger? He no longer understood Earth, if he ever had. He sat there shivering through the dregs of his insomniac nights, too tired to read or to work. He could only call up one Terran news program after another, trying to understand better what was happening down there. He would have to if he wanted to understand Mars, for the transnational's Martian behavior was being driven by Terran ultimate causes. He needed to understand. But the news vid seemed beyond rational comprehension. Down there, even more dramatically than on Mars, there was no plan. He needed a science of history, but unfortunately there was no such thing. History is Lamarckian, Harkady used to say. A notion that was ominously suggestive, given the pseudo-speciation caused by the unequal distribution of the gerontological treatments, but it was no real help. Psychology, sociology, anthropology, they were all suspect. The scientific method could not be applied to human beings in any way that yielded useful information. It was the fact-value problem stated in a different way. Human reality could only be explained in terms of values, and values were very resistant to scientific analysis. Isolation of factors for study, falsifiable hypotheses, repeatable experiments, the entire apparatus as practiced in lab physics simply could not be brought to bear. Values drove history, which was whole, non-repeatable, and contingent. It might be characterized as Lamarckian or as a chaotic system, but even those were guesses, because what factors were they talking about? What aspects might be acquired by learning and passed on, or cycling in some non-repetitive but patterned way? No one could say. He began to think again about the discipline of natural history which had so captivated him on Arena Glacier. It used scientific methods to study the natural world's history, and in many ways that history was just as problematic a methodological problem as human history, being likewise non-repeatable and resistant to experiment. And with human consciousness out of the picture, natural history was often fairly successful, even if it was based mostly on observation and hypothesis that could be tested only by further observation. It was a real science. It had discovered, there among the contingency and disorder, some valid general principles of evolution. Development, adaptation, complexification, and many more specific principles as well, confirmed by the various subdisciplines. What he needed were similar principles influencing human history. The little reading he did in historiography was not encouraging. It was either a sad imitation of the scientific method or art, pure and simple. About every decade, a new historical explanation revised all that had come before, but clearly revisionism held pleasures that had nothing to do with the actual justice of the case being made. Sociobiology and bioethics were more promising, but they tended to explain things best when working on evolutionary timescales, and he wanted something for the past 100 years and the next 100, or even the past 50 and the next 5. Night after night he woke, failed to fall back asleep, got up, sat at the screen and puzzled over these matters, too tired to think well. And as these night watches kept happening, he found himself returning more and more to shows about 2061. There were any number of video compilations on the events of that year, and some of them weren't shy about naming it. World War III was the title of the longest series, some 60 hours worth of video from that year, poorly edited and sequenced. One only had to watch the series for a while to realize that the title was not entirely sensationalist. Wars had raged all over Terra in that fateful year, and the analysts, reluctant to call it the Third World War, seemed to think that it simply hadn't gone on long enough to qualify. Or that it hadn't been the contest of two great global alliances, but was much more confused and complex. Different sources would claim it was North against South, or Young against Old, or UN against Nations, or Nations against Transnationals, or Transnationals against Flags of Convenience, or Armies against Police, or Police against Citizens, so that it began to seem every kind of conflict at once. For a matter of 6 or 8 months, the world had descended into chaos. In the course of his wanderings through political science, Sachs had stumbled across a pseudoscientific chart by Hermann Kahn called an escalation ladder, which attempted to categorize conflicts according to their nature and severity. There were 44 steps in Kahn's ladder, going from the first, ostensible crisis, up gradually through categories like political and diplomatic gestures, solemn and formal declarations, and significant mobilization, then more steeply through steps like show of force, harassing acts of violence, dramatic military confrontations, large conventional war, and then off into the unexplored zones of barely nuclear war, exemplary attacks against property, civilian devastation attack, and right on up to number 44, spasm or insensate war. It was certainly an interesting attempt at taxonomy and logical sequence, and although there were obviously elements of fetishization in the excessive detail, Sachs could see that the categories had been abstracted from many wars of the past. And by the definitions of the table, 2061 had shot right up the ladder to number 44. In that maelstrom, Mars had been no more than one spectacular war among 50. Very few general programs about 61 devoted more than a few minutes to it, and these merely collected clips Sachs had seen at the time. The frozen guards at Korolyov, the broken domes, the fall of the elevator, and then that of Phobos. Attempts at analysis of the Martian situation were shallow at best. Mars had been an exotic sideshow with some good vid, but nothing else to distinguish it from the general morass. No, one sleepless dawn it came to him. If he wanted to understand 2061, he was going to have to piece it together himself from the primary sources of the videotapes, from all the bouncing shots of enraged crowds torching cities, and the occasional press conferences with desperate, frustrated leaders. Even getting these in chronological order was no easy task, and indeed this became, in his Eckes style, his only interest for a few weeks, as slotting events into a chronology was the first step in piecing together what had happened, which had to precede figuring out why. Over the weeks he began to get a sense of it. Certainly the common wisdom was correct. The emergence of the transnationals in the 2040s had set the stage and was the ultimate cause of the war. In that decade, while Sachs had been devoting every bit of his attention to terraforming Mars, a new Terran order had come into being, shaped as the thousands of multinational corporations began to coalesce into the scores of colossal transnationals. Something like planetary formation, he thought one night, planetesimals becoming planets. It was not entirely a new order, however. The multinationals had mostly originated in the wealthy industrial nations, and so in certain senses the transnationals were expressions of these nations, extensions of their power into the rest of the world in a way that reminded Sachs of what little he knew of the imperial and colonial systems that had preceded them. Frank had said something like that. Colonialism had never died, he used to declare. It just changed names and hired local cops. We're all colonies of the transnats. This was Frank's cynicism, Sachs decided, wishing that he had that hard, bitter mind on hand to instruct him, because all colonies were not equal. It was true that transnats were so powerful that they had rendered national governments little more than toothless servants, and no transnat had shown any particular loyalty to any given government or the UN. But they were children of the West, children who no longer cared for their parents, yet still supported them. For the record showed that the industrial nations had prospered under the transnats, while the developing nations had had no recourse but to fight each other for flag of convenience status. And thus in 2060, when the transnats had come under fire from desperate poor countries, it had been the Group of Seven and its military might that had come to their defense. But the proximate cause? Night after night, he sifted through vid of the 2040s and 50s, looking for traces of patterns. Eventually, he decided that it was the longevity treatment which had pushed things over the edge. Through the 2050s, the treatment had spread through the rich countries, illustrating the gross economic inequality in the world like a color stain in a microscope sample. And as the treatment spread, the situation had gotten increasingly tense, rising steadily up the steps of Kahn's ladder of crises. The immediate cause of the explosion of 61, strangely enough, appeared to be a squabble concerning the Martian space elevator. The elevator had been operated by Praxis, but after it had started operations in February of 2061, to be precise, it had been taken over by Subarashi in a clearly hostile takeover. Subarashi, at that time, was a conglomeration of most of the Japanese corporations that had not folded into Mitsubishi, and it was a rising power, very aggressive and ambitious. Upon acquisition of the elevator, a takeover approved by Unoma, Subarashi had immediately increased the emigration quotas, causing the situation on Mars to go critical. At the same time on Earth, Subarashi's competitors had objected to what was effectively an economic conquest of Mars, and though Praxis had confined its objections to legal action at the hapless UN, one of Subarashi's flags of convenience, Malaysia, had been attacked by Singapore, which was a base for Shalalco. By April of 2061, much of South Asia was at war. Most of the fights were long-standing conflicts, such as Cambodia versus Vietnam or Pakistan versus India, but some were attacks on Subarashi flags, as in Burma and Bangladesh. Events in the region had shot up the escalation ladder with deadly speed as old enmities joined the new transnat conflicts, and by June, wars had spread all over Terra and then to Mars. By October, 50 million people had died, and another 50 million were to die in the aftermath, as many basic services had been interrupted or destroyed, and a newly released malaria vector remained without an effective prevention or cure. That seemed enough to qualify it as a world war to Sachs, brevity notwithstanding. It had been, he concluded, a deadly, synergistic combination of fights among the transnats and revolutions by a wide array of disenfranchised groups against the transnat order. But the chaotic violence had convinced the transnats to resolve their disputes, or at least table them, and all the revolutions had failed, especially after the militaries of the Group of Seven intervened to rescue the transnats from dismemberment in their flags of convenience. All the giant military-industrial nations had ended up on the same side, which had helped to make it a very short world war, compared to the first two. Short, but terrible. About as many people had died in 2061 as in the first two world wars together. Mars had been a minor campaign in this Third World War, a campaign in which certain of the transnats had overreacted to a flamboyant but disorganized revolt. When it was over, Mars had been seized firmly in the grip of the major transnationals with the blessing of the Group of Seven and the transnats' other clients. And Terra had staggered on. 100 million people fewer. But nothing else had changed. None of its problems had been addressed. So it all might happen again. It was perfectly possible. One might even say that it was likely.
This ends side 2 of cassette 7 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 8.